Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
Oh, right. And today we have another segment of our Dead White Scientist series.
Oh, those guys just keep dying,
right.
I swear.
And this one is, we're going to talk about the history of oil, or there's no business that's quite so crude.
Ain't that the truth?
So,
even
yes.
Today, you know, I was reading in The Guardian the top 20 most polluting industry in the world. And every single one is the name of an oil and gas company.
Well, at least they're consistent. So let's go back to the early days.
Unfortunately, that's what you believe. All right, we're going to have quite a time today. All right, let's go.
Well, and to get to the very beginning, the oil business largely is an American-born business here, although like every other thing in the world.
Well, the Middle East has had oil.
Oh, but we were first. And actually, the Chinese always and the American Indians always. And I mean, all of these things are always invented these things years ago.
Yes, that's right.
But the dead white scientists were the first ones to write it down and claim credit and patent it and hire lawyers. So that's all that counts. So when we talk about...
Good to know.
The beginning of the oil
That's
industry.
So good to know.
It's interesting because there are a number of entities out there, a number of regions that claim to be the birthplace of at least the North American oil industry. Pennsylvania being maybe the most vocal. West Virginia, I mean, we went to the oil museum down there in Parkersburg, West Virginia, where they claim West Virginia is the birthplace of the oil industry. I will claim that it began in Caldwell, Ohio, where the very first oil well was dug by hand. In fact, we visited there. It's still polluting the groundwater.
It's
so that's
still
awfully
so gross.
it's still a little bit of crude comes bubbling up through a hollow log. And so what they did is they dug a ditch.
So it could go down into the creek that was right below it.
Well,
yeah.
And then
they said they didn't do that.
I know. Well, then just deny it. It never happened.
So nothing's changed, basically.
No, nothing has changed. And we'll touch on that. But if you really wanted to get back to the beginning, probably Abraham Geisner is the very beginning of the oil industry. He was a physician up in Nova Scotia, and he actually refined liquid out of coal, out of an asphalt-type material, and found that it burned in his whale lanterns. And this would have been in he was born in 1797. So the mid 1800s, he was doing this. He was so enthused that he decided to move to New York, make his fortune in all of this. So he started, he called it kerosene, which was an amalgam of a couple of words. It's two words that mean wax and oil. So he was waxing poetic, I guess. Anyway, he started to try and market this, and then the coal industry decided he was a threat. They maintained they had the right to market all things coal, so they sued him.
But it wasn't coal.
Well, they claimed it was because it was oil derived from a coal-like material.
Nothing has changed.
Yeah, I know.
This is 2019. It's
so
still happening.
Essentially, the lawyers put him out of business. He said, you know what? Enough of this stuff. I'm heading back home. So he gave up, died broke. But then other folks started getting into the mix. They found that this oily substance that was percolating out of the ground seeps that the American Indians had used it for years and years as a medicine. They had used it to treat the skins on their canoes to keep them waterproof. So it was a well-known thing.
I don't think they swallowed it, but they might have used it to draw out infection. Because we still do it. We still do that. We still take tar.
But
I just did it this morning with my goat.
I'll tell you that the stuff that they got out of the ground in Caldwell, they were drinking it.
Okay, that was... I'm defending indigenous people.
Okay.
The white
were
people
smarter,
were stupid.
Right?
But
okay.
I'm just saying that tar does draw out infection. So the Indians were right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then... now, why Pennsylvania has a claim to this is... Titusville, Pennsylvania, there was a fellow named Edwin Drake, and he was one of these guys. And the history of oil is filled with these people who are, I'm going to go get rich. I'm going to go do this thing. He was known as Colonel, although nobody quite ever knew that he had served in the military anywhere. And he began, he found oil. He formed what was later called the Seneca Oil Company. And that began kind of the modern oil rush, but it was still pretty small potatoes at that time. And this is all kind of leading up to 1860.
I was going to say, but didn't it's like it always seems like war is what puts these things on the map.
Yeah, well, and it was
the Civil War started in 1861.
Right, and one of the ways they decided to pay for it is they were going to tax alcohol, and a lot of people had been using alcohol, you know, ethanol essentially.
Oh, I was going to say, well, they were drinking it.
Well, they were drinking it, but it's ethanol is just moonshine with some stuff added to it, so you can't drink it. And so this tax policy where they were taxing alcohol at $2.08 a gallon,
wow.
I mean, that's a lot in 1860, but they were taxing kerosene at about 10 cents a gallon. So now kerosene got a big boost through the taxing policies. So that started the push towards the use of kerosene, the use of petroleum-based products. It was all through favorable tax policy from the U.S. government. And that continued on after the Civil War. So people started pushing for the discovery of oil, essentially. And so this was the late 1800s. But from what we would consider to be the oil industry, still relatively small, still Pennsylvania-based oil. But that then led to the emergence of like Rockefeller. John Rockefeller, who was an Ohio boy.
Ohio.
Yeah. Well, at that point, it was Standard Oil of Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And he began saying, okay, if we're going to move all this oil, he became the guy who moved it. And that's where his wealth was. And we've heard in the 1970s, like when the Cuyahoga River up in Cleveland caught on fire. That wasn't the first time that it had caught on fire. Because they were processing this stuff and what we refer to
processing
as gasoline,
the oil.
And what we refer to as gasoline was a waste product that they simply threw into the river. And so they were dumping huge amounts of oil into the Cuyahoga River. And it was oil byproducts. So It was more than just gasoline. And it would catch on fire a number of times. You know.
But I don't think anything really took off until the car. I mean, even though first cars were electric, but I don't think really the use of gasoline and oil was really that popular other than lubricant, was it?
Right. Well, there was for lighting. Kerosene was popular, but then Rockefeller was really the first to push and say, okay, I've got all this byproduct. There's got to be a use for it. And you're right. In the late 1800s, 1890s, those ranges, we were really beginning to see the emergence of the automobile. And those automobiles were either electric, which dominated the early automobile. Steam was another one, although the steam engine was kind of unreliable, took a long time to get started, and blew up occasionally. In fact, famously, James Watt would not allow any vehicle with a steam engine to approach his home or any home that he owned because he was afraid it would explode and damage his house.
Because they did.
And of course, famously also, Henry Ford's wife refused to ride in any vehicle with an internal combustion engine because she didn't want to sit on top of a bomb. So she would only ride in electric vehicles.
Well, plus it was clean. That's the other thing is that electric vehicle would have been really clean, whereas the reason that people wore those coats and goggles and all that stuff is because it was filthy, spewing out smoke, plus the dirt from the pathway that they went on with the car.
Right. Well, and they were hard to start. You know, electric vehicle, you push a button or whatever, it starts.
Yeah.
The automobile with the internal combustion,
you had to crank it.
People broke their arms.
Yeah.
Really, it was because it was marketed to men. It had more power. And the electric vehicle was marketed to women. And at that time, women didn't make the purchasing decisions.
No.
So they didn't
have the right to vote. We sure weren't going to decide what car we were buying.
Right, right. So, but then it became an issue of do I fill the gas tank with ethanol, which was largely at that time made from potatoes, or petroleum products? And there is a large conspiracy theory out there that the entire abolitionists, or not abolitionists, the not during a prohibition, prohibitionist movement, which was in part funded by Rockefeller, was an attempt to make the use of ethanol in vehicles illegal and therefore essentially get rid of the major competition for gasoline, which was his product. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there who will maintain that's the case. I'm not convinced by it, because if that had indeed been the case, then after Prohibition ended, we should have seen everything transition over to ethanol. But we didn't. So anyway, so now you've got the big app, the automobile. So there is a desire for oil, and that oil needs to come from somewhere. So there's an interesting story in East Texas, a place called Spindletop. And Spindletop, it was one of these where, you know, these groups of oil wildcatters, you know, we have that history of wildcatters.
Well, explain what a wildcatter is.
The guys who decide, you know, they're with their last dime, they're going to go out there and drill a well, and they're going to become millionaires.
Yes.
And they're all, it's like gambling in Vegas. They're all that way.
Yeah.
And they're all bunches of colorful characters who don't abide by any laws, both legal, moral, ethical, whatever. And so this particular one, there was a fella named Patilla Higgins, a one-armed guy who was trying to find oil. He hooked up with Captain Anthony Lucas. They were pretty much broke. They actually dug a well with their last dollar to 1,000 feet deep down in a place in East Texas. I'm going by memory here. I think it's Beaumont, Texas. And they hit a gusher, right? 150 feet into the air. This oil was spilling. It took several days. It was like one of those scenes from Giant, you know, where the James
the film,
Dean runs out
yeah,
and gets covered
Hudson,
with oil.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they were producing so much oil from this one well in Spindletop. They were actually producing 100,000 barrels a day from this one well, which was more than all the other oil produced in the country from all the other wells. So this thing was a gusher, right?
But the thing I want to say is I saw this picture, which is just so American. And that is that shortly after this time, if you were to go to that place and look, every few feet, there was one of those oil well rigs. And it was so polluted and so devastated. And it was like hundreds of these things, like a chessboard full of these things. It makes no sense of why people did that.
Oh, it made perfect sense. Everybody, every charlatan, every wildcatter, they all descended. In fact, as you're saying, within a year, they had drilled 440 wells on this one hill.
I know, Spindletop it's just
hill.
Ridiculous.
In fact, you couldn't even get a horse or a cart between these oil derricks.
No, that's the picture I saw.
And what's so funny, which is always the typical way this stuff works, it was estimated because of all of the scams and the process that they went through, they spent about $80 million getting $50 million worth of oil out of the ground. So, and in fact, many people were selling their oil rigs and their well leases to multiple people. They would sell it 20 times, you know, to the same thing, but sell it to 20 different people. So it was quite a disaster. And famously, Lucas, the guy who discovered it, he said, this cow was just milked too hard. And then they walk away. That's the typical
And leave
way.
It.
Oh, yeah.
But that still happens today with everything, whether it's a quarry for gravel or oil or whatever. Nobody's held accountable for what they've created.
All right. Well, you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God, especially about this issue.
Oh, but this issue never ends because this is a recurring theme
in the
history of oil. So they came in, they found Spindletop, they found this thing. They not only exploited it with 440 wells. They pumped that sucker dry, and within 3 years, it was gone. I mean, the whole thing was gone. And then they walked away and left a mess.
But they've done that everywhere. I mean, I know at the Parkersburg, West Virginia Museum, Oil and Gas Museum, you see example after example of that during that time period where they would go in and just put up all those oil rigs. And of course, they've done that today with injection wells and gas fracking, where they actually sink a well and they may have $1 million or more in that, and then they made a mistake, and they just walk away and leave it sit there.
Surely you jest.
I've been to these places where they've done that, where they just leave it wide open. It's a big hole. It's unbelievable. Well, and this is 2019.
It's the history of oil. This is a recurring theme. So in America, while we were blowing up bits of East Texas and Oklahoma, the British decided they would start going towards the Middle East. And there was some folks.
What's that mean? You mean looking for oil?
Yeah. So a fellow.
What made them think they could do that? Why would that?
That seemed a likely place. So they must have had some indication.
Yeah.
Actually, the fella Darcy, who was the first to really exploit it around the year 1900, he was going to the Middle East, to Iran, to try and find silver and gold. So he was just a colonialist trying to exploit the resources of these locations. And it wasn't until he was convinced by George Reynolds, who was his operator down there, that oil was a thing, and that they could really make some money with oil. So the Shah of Persia, Muzaffar al-Din, he was this old corrupt leader of Persia, which is Iran. So Darcy gave him £10,000.
Whoa, that would have been a lot of money.
Yeah, a fair amount. And he said, maybe we'll give you a little bit of money later, but just give me the right to pump oil out of Iran. And they looked for it. They spent several years. He had Reynolds running around in the desert, spent a lot of money looking for it. Finally, he gave up. He said, I sent a telegram to Reynolds saying, quit, you know, close up shop, go home. Reynolds famously said he didn't want to give up. So he said, telegraphs are inherently unreliable. So he sent a telegraph back saying, be sure to confirm by letter what it is that you want me to do. And in the meantime, he struck oil. And
that's quite a story.
With one day to spare before they were going to shut down. And ultimately, they found so much oil that Darcy received the equivalent of $55 million worth of oil out of the ground. And this was Anglo-Persian Oil Company that he formed. Of course, after Reynolds found this oil, he got fired. He was fired because your job is over, and was given £1,000 severance pay, told to take a hike. So this, once again, is the legacy of the oil industry.
Well, the real legacy, though, is that this was a rich area, the Middle East, of tribes and history and culture and invention, and they came in and treated them like they were, you know, idiots out of some jungle somewhere, and took advantage. And
well,
it's still happening.
Yeah, and that didn't end, and it had some ramifications in modern day. In Iran, later in the 1950s, Anglo-Persian, which actually later became BP, they were owned primarily by the British government. That's a whole different story with Winston Churchill buying a controlling interest so that they could get oil from the Middle East. And in the 1950s, the then duly elected president of Iran said, you know what, we should share in some of the revenues of this company that is exploiting our country. And BP said, no way, Jose. So the American government, the CIA, and the British government through, I think it's what, MI6, their foreign entity, they essentially overthrew and assassinated the elected president of Iran and then instituted the Shah, who was more favorable to the oil company's desire. And that, of course, later led to the whole, fundamentalist overthrowing of the Shah by Ayatollah Khomeini and And we're still living with that legacy.
Yeah, so, and it all goes on. It's like just repeating itself over and over and over. But let's move on to World War One.
World War One. Oh, yes.
Because that became the next big stepping
stone. Well, World War One, and this is one of those things, like, you remember in school, you're taught about why did World War One begin, and we all are taught it was Franz Ferdinand riding in a carriage down in Serbia.
And
he gets assassinated, yes. And everybody goes to war. Well, it that didn't make sense then when I was in eighth grade, and it still doesn't make sense. Literally, World War One was the first war fought over oil. And what was happening is the Germans were transitioning their military from coal to oil. The British, under Winston Churchill as a young man, was transferring their navy and their armies from coal to oil. There were a lot of strategic advantages of doing that. Well, neither Germany or England had oil. They had coal, but they didn't have oil. So they all decided it was the Middle East that they needed to go and control. So they worked out some deals with England, signed a contract to get the oil from Kuwait. Germany was building a railway to go down to Mesopotamia, which is current-day Iraq. And it really all just came down to, as soon as Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, that was the excuse to start the war that was going to start anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really over the Middle East, over control of the Middle East oil fields. And we see this, the British being victorious after World War One. Wrote in the Treaty of Versailles, they basically divvied up the Middle East amongst the victors.
Right.
And they did this without regard of traditional cultural borders. And once again, we're living with the consequences
of
that.
Yes, that's right, of all the white boys. But one of the things that occurred to me is, you know, the U.S. military is now transitioning to renewable energy. I wonder if we'll have a war.
A war over
somebody get assassinated
over the sun.
Transitioning the U.S. military transitioning to renewable. It's not just the sun, but they have pedestals installed and they're doing all kinds of amazing things for the military.
Well, it's funny as we're going through this from fossil fuels to renewables. Right now, we're starting to see the oil companies arguing. They've been arguing all along, you should leave us alone because free markets will dictate. Now that the free market is dictating not in their favor, they're jumping up and down and saying, oh, the renewables are unfairly competing because of cost and all of that. Well, this, again, is not a new thing. Back when Teddy Roosevelt split up the Standard Oil into all of these smaller companies, the argument there was by not having these cartels, we could then reduce the cost of oil. Well, it worked, and it worked too well. When they started discovering a lot of oil in Texas, and the wildcatters were creating a large amount of supply, oil prices plummeted from about $2 a barrel down to about 10 cents a barrel. And the oil companies were just freaking out about this. And they were complaining that they were not making the kind of profits that, you know, God intended them to make. And so what they did is they called in the governor of Texas, who then sent in the Texas Rangers. And they began arresting anybody who was producing oil, who wasn't part of their group.
Yeah, their designated
right.
cartel.
And in fact, they were arresting as many as 100 oil workers every day. Now, all of this was 100% illegal, but by the time they worked through the courts that it was illegal.
World War II comes
no,
about.
No, 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 that's a different thing.
Oh, shoot, I thought sure that was
no,
it.
No, this was during the 20s, but they kept producing and kept producing. So then they went to the national government, and the national government stepped in and actually began putting quotas and price controls and all of the things the free market folks would find abhorrent, but the oil companies were begging them for this stuff. And Harold Ickes, who was the Secretary of the Interior at that point, he put all of these things into play. Once again, they were 100% illegal, but
that doesn't stop this government.
Right. And then we get to the point where by the time the Supreme Court ruled that it was 100% illegal, and that they had violated all the antitrust rules and all these other laws. Then we begin to see World War II coming up.
Okay.
So the president actually stepped in and exempted the oil companies from all prosecution, from all of these lawsuits for national security purposes. And at that point, we see that they are now getting exactly what they want, right? Almost unlimited demand, price controls, a cartel that's working quite efficiently. And then it got to the point where the Middle East became the problem, because all of these Arab countries whose oil was being exploited by BP, by Chevron, by Aramco, which was the Arabian American oil company, they began trying to reassert their own dominance of their own countries. And in Saudi Arabia, right after World War II, the Saudi Arabian government, the first thing they said is, hey, we want to take a look at the books. Well, they refused. The oil companies refused to let them look. At that point, they announced, okay, we're gonna take 50% of your profits. And then they totally freaked out. Now, they were talking about maybe invading and doing what they did in Iran. But actually, Truman, who was dealing with Korea, he was dealing with Korea, he was dealing with the establishment of Israel. What he came up with is said, okay, you can give the Saudi Arabian government 50%, and we'll treat that as a foreign tax. So you can 100% deduct that off of your U.S. taxes. So when the oil companies paid $46 million to Saudi Arabia, they deducted $46 million from the American tax rolls. And so essentially, the American people paid for the subsidizing to that full extent. And that was in place. It was called the Golden Gimmick. Basically, they all patted themselves on the back, keeping us out of war. That was in place from 1950 until 1980, at which point Saudi Arabia said, you know what, we'll just take all of the oil.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to nationalize everything.
So that has been sort of the history of the oil industry. It's not a pretty picture.
It's still not a pretty picture, as we started out saying, that they are the biggest polluters in the world.
And they tend to have the boom-bust cycles. They tend, once again, as we see over and over, of privatizing profit, socializing risk. Anytime there's a problem, they ask government to step in and make sure that they are insured of a profit. So anytime anybody says that we live in a capitalistic society, as George Bernard Shaw said, capitalism is self-interest enforced with force, you know, mandated by force.
Well, I wonder, too, what's going to change?
Well, we'll find out next show, I'm sure. You've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our award-winning producer, Adam Rich, and we want to thank you and Exxon for joining us today.
No, we're not thanking Exxon.
And as your grandmother probably told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is?
Play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and get yourself an electric car.
All right. Till next time.
Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed. Come out, see the light glowing, blossom in the night. Know the sky's dancing in twilight. Soon we'll be together, all will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.